Epilogue. The bridge of Pride of Salonia was the quietest it had been for a while, with only a handful of crew members working at stations around where Leia sat at the communications console. For the last couple of days it had been kept busy, along with the Widowmaker, mopping up the stragglers of the Yuuzhan Vong strike force that had attacked Asfandia. But now that there was a lull in activities, the crew were concentrating on preparing to return to Mon Calamari for a well-earned break. Millennium Falcon was doing likewise, docked for the moment with the Salonia, while it underwent diagnostic checks and minor repairs. Captain Mayne had given Leia permission to use the bridge's communications facilities to test out the antenna array. While she waited for the go-ahead from Commander Ashpadar, she distracted herself by observing the planet below on the monitors around her. From orbit, the gray atmosphere of Asfandia appeared unchanged. Bathed only by starlight and the occasional dry flash, the planet had absorbed the recent injections of thermal energy as a lake would absorb a teaspoon of salt, returning to its near-absolute zero state within a matter of hours. Glancing at it via Pride of Salonia's instruments, Leia hoped the Burlborp lifeforms had returned to their normal ways of life, chatting among themselves and sifting edible motes from the dense air in which they floated. She wondered how long the stories of the battle that had brought bright light to their skies for the first time would circulate, and whether it would encourage an outward surge in their culture. "Princess Leia," a voice with as much emotion as a droid crackled out of the comm. Leia put her thoughts to one side. "I'm here, Commander." "Engineer Gantry has completed her preliminary checks of the antenna array and pronounces it ready for a test run," Ashpadar said. She didn't have to manufacture her relief. "That's excellent. Tell Fan I'm impressed." "I shall do so." Even through the wooden tone, Leia thought she detected a flicker of pride. "You can commence transmission when you are ready. I presume you'll be monitoring it. I'll need to check signal quality and perform further calibrations." "Understood. Give me 20 seconds. Leia closed the comm line and activated the transceiver. She punched in the sequence for Mon Calamari. A signal check came back green almost immediately. So far, so good, she thought. Next, she keyed Cal Ilmis's private number, vaguely aware that it would have been close to the middle of the night where he was on the distant water world. "Here goes nothing," she muttered to herself. Seconds later, the Chief of State of the Galactic Federation of Free Alliances appeared in the holoprojector.
"Whoever this is," he said bleary-eyed, "you'd better have a good reason for calling me on my private number at—"
"What's the matter, Cal? Did I disturb your beauty sleep?" He blinked back sleep, squinting from the holo display.
"Leia, is that you?"
"You don't even recognize me?" Leia affected a hurt expression. "It hasn't been that long, surely."
"It's not that," he said. "Just the holo is kind of fuzzy. Besides which, I'm half asleep."
"I'm sorry to wake you, Cal," she said sincerely. "But I figured you'd want to know that we've repaired the communications base at Asfandia. Ganaris won't be far behind."
"This couldn't have waited until morning."
Leia smiled. He was steadily waking up, and the grumpiness became more of an act with every passing second. "I'll bet Grand Admiral Pelion doesn't take this long to get himself together."
"I'll bet the Grand Admiral sleeps in his uniform,"
Omis said.
"Why do you mention Pelion anyway? Is he there too?"
"Indeed he is," Leia said, "as are the Rin."
"The Rin? What have they got to do with anything?"
He sighed, knuckling his eyes.
"Maybe you should just explain from the beginning what's been going on, Leia."
"It could take a while.
I plan to be back in bed in 10 minutes, so skip the exposition," he said. "Is this transmission secure?"
"No, not at this end anyway. But what I'm telling you isn't a secret here. It's common knowledge." Leia summarized the Battle of Asfandia in as few sentences as possible. Cal Omis nodded throughout. He didn't interrupt to ask questions, and she admired that in him. A good chief of state had to trust the judgment of those under him. And Cal Omis was turning into a very good chief of state.
"So you caught the traitor,"
he said as she neared the end of the story.
"And you repelled the Yuuzhan Vong. That's excellent work, Leia. Did you ever find out why they didn't want the base knocked out? That's the only thing I don't get out of all this."
"Han and I interrogated Teg when things settled down, The best we can work out is that Vorek gave instructions for Teg to send a distress call from the base. Once Ashpadar was out of the way, the distress call would read that the base was under attack by Chiss Clawcraft and would end with the base being destroyed for real. We don't think Vorek would have left us with an asset like this intact.
But you do think he was continuing that wretched policy of setting neighbors against each other?
Sowing confusion and dissent, Leia said, nodding. Absolutely. It would have taken us ages to clear up the mess. And who knows what damage might have been done. Certainly, given what happened to Luke on Scylla, there are enough factions on both sides who don't want us working together. It wouldn't be hard for a spark like that to create a fire.
Not this time, though, he said, smiling in approval. You've done an excellent job, Leia.
She smiled politely and changed the subject. Is Mon Cal safe to come back to?
For now it is, yes. We've picked up some recon traffic on the outer edge of the system, but nothing has tried to get through. There have been only a few major strikes anywhere, for that matter. Sov thinks they're regrouping, building up forces for a big push.
Just like us.
Exactly. If you're thinking of coming back to check in, now might be a good time to refresh those pilots of yours.
Understood, she said. His face took on a serious cast.
I don't want to risk losing one of the best assets I have, Leia. I'd like you here in case we need you. There are others I can send to take your place in these communications hot spots. Now you've identified the problem, it won't be so hard to fix.
Credit where credit's due, Cal, she said. The Rin did this for us and got us out of a nasty scrape. I want them accorded the respect they deserve.
Maybe so, but Gron isn't going to like dealing with them.
I wouldn't have thought Marab would be in any position to dispute an order. After all, his network didn't have a clue as to what was going on, nor did the other spy networks, for that matter. Omis nodded.
Believe me, Leia, I take your point.
Good night, Cal, she said, smiling fondly at him. We'll talk again soon. When he was gone, Leia sank back into the seat, using the quiet moment to close her eyes and turn to her thoughts. The peace didn't last long. A few seconds later, the comm unit called for attention with a sharp buzz. Leia leaned forward, speaking into the comm. Is that you, Commander Ashpadar? It is, Princess, came the Gotal woman's reply. Just letting you know that the antenna array performed adequately, but we would like also to test it in the other direction, away from the core. I might be able to help you there, Leia said. Give me a second. Before she could activate the comm again, though, she heard her husband's voice from behind her. She swiveled around to face him, watching as he made his way over to her, sidestepping the few crew members working around the bridge.
There you are, he said, coming over to stand beside her. Captain Main said I could find you here.
Ashpadar has the array working, she said. We're just testing it out. He nodded distractedly, as though not really listening.
Have you seen Droma?
Not recently, she thought back. Did he come up with us when we left the base?
I'm pretty sure he did. But I was also concentrating on flying at the time, so...
The sentence trailed off into a shrug as he stood and made again to leave.
Oh, well, maybe Jaina knows.
Before you go, Leia said, I was going to see if I could raise Luke, in case you're interested. A familiar smile broke through his look of concern.
Sure, why not? Let's see how the old farm boy is doing.
Leia tapped in the codes for Jade Shadow and waited as the network searched for the ship's distinctive signature out of the many in the unknown regions. It took a lot longer than it had to raise Mon Calamari, but eventually the face of her sister-in-law appeared in the holodisplay, grinning broadly.
Ah, there you are,
Mara said, her expression not hiding her relief.
Finally paid your bills, did you?
Elegance Enshrined swooped low out of the trees, emitting a hooting cry that made the leaves and branches shake. Thousands of leaping insects and birds cavorting in the airship's wake, gleaming a thousand colors, scattered wildly, thrown into chaos. Thin-limbed climbers responded with hoots and howls of their own as they jumped up and down agitatedly. Saba, safely ensconced in the ship's gondola, exposed her teeth in a smile. The air was full of sound and excitement. The sun was warm, and Mobus bulged high in the sky, like an improbably colored balloon. The hunt was over, Sonoma Seacoat had agreed to lend its considerable weight to the war effort. Much was yet to be decided, particularly how exactly the Living Planet would contribute, but the essentials were there. Everything Master Skywalker had set out to do had been achieved. They could finally go home. Home. The thought held less bitterness for Sabah than it had in previous weeks. Despite the obvious differences in climate and topography between Barib 1 and Zonama Seacoat, Sabah felt comfortable on the Living Planet. The air was warm, even when it rained. The constant moisture meant paying frequent attention to her scales and claws to ensure no fungal infections took root, but that wasn't an insurmountable problem. She had certainly visited a lot less inviting planets in her travels. Jubitha had made it clear that she could stay if she wanted, for as long as she needed. It was an invitation Sabah appreciated, and although she hadn't decided one way or the other yet, if she was honest with herself, she had to admit that the offer was a tempting one. Zonama would be a good place to spend time healing, something she hadn't allowed herself to do since the incident on Barib 1. Not properly, anyway. The hunter in her had not allowed it. But she could understand now that it was important. When she closed her eyes to think of her planet, she didn't want to see fires raging across its face, but the rugged beauty of its once great mountains and valleys. When she slept, her dreams shouldn't be haunted by the faces of her people spilling from the slave ship, but the faces of all the friends and family she'd had while growing up on Barib 1. The time had come, she decided, to stop remembering her homeworld in death, and instead remember it in life. Not just hunting the moment, she thought, but hunting the future as well.
It's beautiful, is it not?
Krajba. The airship's companion came to sit next to her as Elegance Enshrined glided effortlessly toward the landing field.
This one finds it.
She took her time choosing the word.
Exquisite.
During the crossings, much of this was destroyed. The Boris, the Tompasi, the animals.
He swept one hand across the view through the gondola window. Danny, Soren Hegarty, and Tekli listened to the man's words, although he directed them to Sabah.
It was a terrible time. Many of us hid underground, in special shelters Seacoat grew for us. Darkness covered the sky, and every leap through the void made that darkness thicker. The world shook until we feared it would crack.
Krajba's gaze drifted off to somewhere in the past.
We all lost someone.
This one is sorry for your loss.
He smiled toothily in appreciation of her words before continuing.
I remember the day the shelters opened for the last time and the clouds finally parted. We saw sanctuary hanging in the sky, and we knew that Seacoat was happy. We'd found our new home at last. There were celebrations all around Zonama. Dancing, fine foods, drinking. So much laughter. It went on for a week, but being only a young boy at the time, it seemed to me a lifetime.
The thought of going back into the shelters, Sabah said, guessing ahead to the point of the story. It worries you.
He shook his head.
I thought it would, but it doesn't.
Even though you might never be able to return to Sanctuary?
Danny asked from the next bench along.
The airship pilot shrugged. I figure we've had a good run to remain free of hostilities for as long as we have, he said. And if Seacoat can make the difference that your Jedi Master believes, then maybe it won't be for too long anyway. Seacoat can win the war for you, and then perhaps we can return here.
Somehow I don't think it's going to be that easy, said Hegarty at Sabah's rear.
Another shrug. I guess we'll find out soon enough.
I have to admit, Danny said, you're a lot calmer about all this than I expected.
Yes, Hegarty said, certainly more accepting than the likes of Roel and Darek.
The burly Ferrowin smiled at this. They'll come around to the idea, I'm sure, he said. What choice do they have? Seacoat has made its decisions. We must trust in its judgment. If we don't, then perhaps we shouldn't be living here in the first place.
They're scared, Tekli said. Most would be after so long of peace.
I know, Krajb said, but Seacoat will protect us, and it won't be like the last time. We've been busy these long years. We have planetary shields built into the mountain ranges that should keep things intact during the jumps. And you've seen how well Seiko can handle itself against an outside attack. He shrugged. What's there to be afraid of?
The conversation came to an end as Elegance Enshrined began her final descent to a stretch of wide grasslands. Saba saw Master Skywalker and Jason Solo standing with Jibitha and Seacoat's Vergere persona near Jade Shadow. Preparations for the journey would begin as soon as the visitors relocated to another community in the region called Middle Distance. There was still much to organize and decide, but Saba was confident that the most important decisions were now behind them. All that remained was to do. Elegance dropped the last 10 meters with a stomach-wrenching lurch. Saba and the others held on for balance until, seconds later, the tall grass of the field was brushing the underside of the gondola. Then they came to a halt, with the airship's body above them rippling in strange and hypnotic undulations. As the others climbed down the ladder to the ground, Saba held back, staring at the tranquil setting around her. It was green and lush, and the air was both rich and invigorating. Tsunami Seacoat was indeed a seductive tempter. But she cautioned herself not to become too enamored of the living planet. Beautiful though it was, it held life and death in the same proportions as everywhere else. Its surface teemed with tiny tragedies. It wasn't an oasis from the evils of the universe, by any means. The only thing its controlling intelligence had done was give it purpose and attempt to make it safe from the outside. Nothing more. Seacoat, who had more than adequately demonstrated a capacity to be cruel, was the epitome of nature itself.
Jason told it not to fight, Saba reminded herself. But still it comes. Is that the action of a peace-loving intelligence? Or is it the next step in its evolution? From easy prey to hunter.
She shook her head. The concept was too big for her to deal with right now. It would have to wait for another time, for the future, perhaps, to reveal. She clambered over the side of the gondola and made her way down the creaking vine ladder. When her feet touched the ground, she felt an overwhelming sense of completion. Her hunt was over. She had acquitted herself and brought honor to the memory of her people. Whatever fate had in store for her now, she was confident she was ready to deal with it. Jaina fumed as Pride of Solonia's chief medical officer examined her skull with his long fingers. It seemed to be taking forever, and was made all the more irritating because of the humming noise he made while doing it. Jaina endured it for as long as she could before pulling away.
Come on, Doc, can't you just give me a straight answer?
She said, looking up into his large red eyes.
Are you going to let me fly or not? My foot is completely healed.
Dantos Vigos turned away to make some notes in her case file. One more day.
What difference is that going to make? She objected. I'm either ready or I'm not.
Then you're not, Vigos said. The red eyes turned back to her. Look, Colonel Solo, I can understand your eagerness to get back to your squadron, but I cannot in good conscience give you the okay to return to duty until your balance has fully returned to normal.
Vigos offered a smile, and Jaina was forced to concede the argument. She knew he was right. After the knock to the head she'd received on Esfandia, her sense of balance hadn't been entirely perfect. That very morning in the Salonia's corridor, the deck had bobbed beneath her feet when she'd least expected it, and she had completely lost her sense of direction.
Okay, she said with poor grace, but I'll be back the same time tomorrow.
Vigos nodded his leathery head.
Until then, Colonel Solo.
Jaina left the examination room and headed back to the squadron barracks, grumbling all the way about the injustice of the situation. Her mood wasn't helped any when she got to the squad room to find it empty. Everyone else, it seemed, was out on patrol or helping the Imperials clean up the skies above Esfandia. There was an awful lot of debris floating around, any amount of which could plummet to the planet below and damage the newly repaired antenna array. Not to mention disrupting the environment. Now that the Galactic Alliance knew the isolated world was inhabited, extra steps were being taken to ensure that the inhabitants were left in peace. She took a seat and watched the cleanup operation on the monitors for a half an hour or so, occasionally offering suggestions but trying as hard as she could to stay out of Jag's way. He was perfectly capable of running the squadron without her, and she knew she shouldn't interfere. As the orbiting garbage dump slowly took shape, though, swelling in size to resemble a large and craggy asteroid, she couldn't resist buzzing Jag to suggest that they name it Vorik's Folly, in honor of the Yuuzhan Vong commander who'd given his life to help create it. So absorbed was she in her observance of her squadron's activities that she didn't even notice when the door behind her opened and someone stepped in.
"Is this a bad time?"
Startled, Jaina jumped from her seat and turned toward the voice.
"Hello, Tahiri."
The younger woman smiled as she stepped closer. Her pale yellow hair was much shorter than it used to be, and she wore her active duty combat suit everywhere she went, sealed right up to the neck. She was even wearing shoes, which took a bit of getting used to for Jaina. She didn't know if the girl was attempting to hide her scars with the outfit, or if her combined personality simply liked the uniform. Either way, it made a distinctive sight. Her expression, even behind the smile, was guarded and full of concentration, as though she were feeling her way blind through a very different culture. Perhaps that's exactly what was happening, Jaina thought. The old Tahiri would have found everything familiar, while Rina would be seeing it all for the first time. There was no longer any separation between the two personalities, but the new persona possessed both at the same time. It would be like the opposite of deja vu, she imagined.
"What can I do for you?" she asked.
"I wanted to talk," Tahiri said, "if you have time."
Jaina returned to her seat.
"It's not as if my schedule is filled at the moment."
Tahiri picked a chair opposite where Jaina had been sitting and perched herself on the edge. All her energy was contained and focused. It made her seem very mature, despite her youthful appearance. Her reopened scars had healed into cold white lines.
"I came to say that I am sorry," Tahiri said.
Jaina frowned.
"For what?"
"There are many reasons. I wish it known that I regret the hardship you went through on my behalf, and I'm sorry mainly that they chose you."
Jaina shook her head, confused.
"Chose me? Who chose me? For what?"
"They came to you on Mon Calamari. The old me and Rina had different reasons, but they both chose you. If anyone could help them, it was going to be you."
Jaina fought the conceptual complication of Tahiri referring to her previous selves as though they were completely separate identities, and concentrated instead on what she was trying to say.
"I remember when the old Tahiri called me," she said. "She thought Anakin was trying to kill her. Was that Rina talking?"
Tahiri nodded.
"Partly, but it was also me, for I was still plagued by guilt. The old me felt as though she had abandoned Anakin by moving on emotionally with her life. She believed she should have done more for him, or perhaps even died with him."
There were tears in the young woman's eyes, but all other emotions were carefully contained.
"We were on the brink of mental collapse, sharing one body, some memories, and little personality. Neither wanted the other to survive, but I think Rina knew first what had to be done. Without merging, both would have died, or lost what sanity we had left. As our fragile equilibrium crumbled around us, we threw ourselves at the only person who could help us, trusting her to do what was right, even if she didn't know at the time what that was."
"I think I'm beginning to understand," Jaina said soberly.
"You reminded us of Anakin, Jaina," Tahiri went on. "You were his sister and are like him in many ways. We felt we could trust you. We felt sure that you would be there for us should we have needed you. To end it, or to rescue us, either way."
Tahiri's expression was grave.
"I, the new Tahiri, the person who has inherited everything those two were, am grateful we did choose you. I shall always be in your debt, Jaina, for what you did for us."
Tahiri lowered her head, and Jaina fought to find a way to lighten the situation. She'd seen what debts did to people.
"Listen," she said, "it's really no big deal. Anyone would have done what I did."
Tahiri stood and nodded once respectfully.
"Thank you for your words, Jaina, and thank you for hearing mine."
Jaina studied the young woman before her, wondering exactly who this new person was and how she would turn out. There seemed so little left of the girl who once occupied the body.
"Tahiri," she said as the girl made to leave.
Tahiri stopped and faced her.
"I just want you to know that, although you've obviously changed, my feelings for you haven't. I still regard you as a friend."
Something shifted behind Tahiri's cool green eyes, and for a moment, Jaina thought she might smile. There was a noise in the doorway, and they both turned to see Han walk into the room. Jaina stood.
Dad, what are you doing here?
What? A father can't come and visit his sick daughter?
I'm not sick.
Grounded, then. Same thing, right?
Han's smile was wide, enjoying the game. She smiled in return. Whatever. What's up, anyway?
I was wondering if you happen to know where Droma might be. I can't seem to find him anywhere.
He came off-world with us, she said, but I don't remember what happened to him after we docked. What about you, Tahiri? Have you—
Her question went no farther, as Tahiri was no longer in the squad room. Jaina assumed that she had slipped out as soon as Jaina's father had begun talking. Her father's expression mirrored her own surprise.
She can sure move quietly when she wants to, he said.
Then, with a little awkwardness, he added,
Is she— She's fine, Dad,
Jaina cut in, anticipating her father's concern. He nodded, accepting Jaina's reassurance.
I guess I'm still kind of nervy when it comes to the Yuuzhan Vong.
I understand, Dad, she said. Really, I do. But Tahiri just needs time to settle in.
Then, returning them to the original topic, she said,
You might want to check with the Salonia to see if they know where Droma might be. Someone's bound to have noticed him about the place somewhere.
Her father chuckled.
Are you kidding? We're talking about a Rin here, remember? They're the most ignored beings in the galaxy. That's what makes them such good spies.
He shrugged.
But I guess it couldn't hurt. What's Mom up to, anyway?
Up on the Salonius Bridge, helping test the antenna array.
Maybe I'll join her, see if she'd like some help.
Her father's smile was wry as he said,
You really must be bored. No one at all.
Grand Admiral Pelion stared at the image of Captain Maine of Pride of Salonia with undisguised surprise.
There must be someone in charge.
You have to remember that this isn't a fleet as you and I are used to, Maine said. It's not much more than a group of individuals working together, albeit a large group. There's not much organization to them, as far as I can see, and that's reflected in the way they're dispersing. They're not moving out en masse, but in dribs and drabs, when they feel like leaving.
So who's giving the orders?
Pelion asked.
Most of the ones I've spoken to have said they receive orders through unusual means, she said. None of them knew about the others until they assembled at the rendezvous where they awaited your signal. Most of them hadn't even heard of any Rin network as such until we explained what we knew. As far as they are concerned, they're just returning a favor someone did for them. Sometime in the last year, they seem as much in the dark about it all as we are.
The whole concept mystified the Grand Admiral, and yet at the same time he couldn't help but be impressed by the way the Rin worked. It was the loosest possible cell system in action. Every active member of the Rin network was in contact with only two or three immediately nearby, but no more. That way, there was no chance of anyone following the trail from the bottom to the top. But there had to be a top, or at least a genesis point. They had to have come from somewhere.
Well, we owe them a favor now, he said.
So it would seem, Captain Maine said. I guess that's the whole idea.
Pelion nodded.
Not only are these people keeping tabs on what's happening in the black spots of the galaxy, but they're helping knit them back together again, too.
There's nothing like fighting side by side to create a bond between perfect strangers.
Even old enemies,
Pelion said with a half-smile.
I have to admit, Admiral, that at first I was wary of you. I felt you might be hiding something from us.
Maine paused.
I just want to say that I hope you can forgive my suspicions. It's hard at times to shake the habit of a lifetime.
Pelion's smile widened.
I don't mind what people think of me, Captain, as long as they obey orders.
I'll happily follow orders, sir, so long as they're good ones.
Pelion barked out a laugh.
It's been a pleasure working with you. I hope this isn't the last time we serve together.
I'm sure we'll serve together again, Admiral. There are still plenty of battles out there left to fight.
Pelion's mustache twitched.
I have visited many systems in my travels, said the image of Verger, and of the cultures that inhabited them. None have I seen that did not embrace hostilities to some degree or another.
Luke listened carefully to what Seacoat was saying, even as his gaze remained fixed on the spectacle of the airship descending to the grasslands. He could see the hide of the giant creature rippling as she slid gracefully through the air. Her entire body flexed, bringing her and her passengers to a near-perfect halt less than a meter above the ground.
"I have seen battles in Gulf cities and sometimes entire countries,"
Seacoat went on.
"There have even been conflicts that have extended between worlds. It is almost as though the desire for war has spread like a plague through the life forms of this galaxy."
"Not all sentient life desires war," Luke said, watching as the passengers disembarked from the gondola. "The Jedi dedicate their efforts toward peace."
"From what I have seen, peace does not seem to be the natural state of the universe," Seacoat said.
Luke turned at this to face Seacoat. "It surprises me that one who's supposed to be as in touch with the living force as yourself would think this way."
"As it surprises me that one as small as yourself would presume to have such insight into the living force's moral bent."
Luke faced the image fully now, smiling. "On the first night we came here, Jubitha said something similar to my nephew." The Magister looked up at his words, but didn't interrupt. "She became indignant that Jason should dare speak for the living force. The implication was that someone so small in the great cosmos shouldn't dare presume to speak for such a powerful thing. But the fact is, the living force can choose anyone it wants. Size is not important. Master Yoda was smaller than anyone here, yet he was the wisest person I ever met, as well as one of the most powerful Jedi masters to ever live. You possess a power, Seacoat, that is beyond the imagining of virtually all sentient beings. But that doesn't automatically mean that your connection to the Force is greater." The image of Vergeir indicated approval with a smile and a nod.
"You are wise, Master Skywalker," Seacoat said. "I think in the days to come, you will supply many answers to the questions I still have regarding the Force."
"This is the beginning of a long journey for us all," Luke returned. "By its end, I think we will have learned much from each other." Then, facing the Magister, he asked, "How are preparations coming along, Jubitha?"
"Preparations are well underway for our departure," she said. "The last 3 days have seen many changes around Zonama."
"Or not seen," Jason said, referring to the intense electrical activity that had obscured many locations around the planet's equator. Jubitha laughed. She and Seacoat seemed to have taken quite a liking to Luke's nephew.
"Had you wished to know what we were up to," she said, "then you had but to ask."
"That's okay," Jason said. "I have a feeling that I wouldn't have understood half of what you were saying anyway." Before anyone could reply, the others had joined them. Saba's muscular tail made swishing noises in the grass. Hegarty was holding a satchel full of what appeared to be Ferroan artifacts, judging by the bits and pieces sticking out of it. Tekli's fur was bristling in the gentle breeze, and Danny moved to stand near Jason, still slightly wary of their Ferroan escort. Darak and Roel were being much more civilized to their guests now that Seacoat had officially embraced them. Not only had they volunteered to take the four not actively involved in discussions of the future on a tour of the neighboring countryside, but they'd made sure that their accommodations were more than adequate, almost opulent, and that they were treated with deference. It marked a dramatic shift in their relations with the natives, and Luke wondered sometimes whether it was simply a case of being told by Seacoat to be polite, or if there might be more subtle forces at work. Perhaps living in the life energies of a planet-sized mind put them more in tune with its thoughts than they realized. Certainly there was no sign of the hostility that had originally greeted the Jedi landing party. Even Senshi had reverted to being friendly, having been set free of Seacoat's persuasive influence.
"We went to ruins," Danny told Jason.
"It's incredible," Hegarty said excitedly. "You won't believe what we found."
Luke found himself smiling at the gray-haired scientist's enthusiasm, but only half listened to what she had to say about indigenous species versus those introduced by the Ferroans. He couldn't blame her for her excitement. After all, Zonama Seacoat was a world filled with secrets and mysteries just waiting to be discovered. It would have been a dream come true for any scientist.
Luke,
Mara's voice broke across his thoughts, and he turned to see her approaching through the tall grass.
All systems go?
He asked.
Better than that, she said. We have contact with Mon Calamari again.
Luke didn't hesitate. Excusing himself from the group, he hurried with his wife back to Jade Shadow with Jason close behind. Being out of contact with the rest of the galaxy hadn't sat comfortably with him the whole time they'd been on Zonama Seacoat. Who knew what had happened to the war, to Leia and Han, or to Ben? R2-D2 whistled reassuringly as he hurried past to the cockpit. In the holoprojector flickered the long, aristocratic face of Kent Hamner. His mouth was moving, but there was no sound.
I didn't say it was perfect, Mara said, sitting at the pilot station and fiddling with the controls. We're getting a data feed, though. It looks like nothing drastic has gone wrong while we've been out of touch.
Luke skimmed through lines of text scrolling down a screen behind Hamner, who had stopped talking, obviously realizing that he wasn't being heard. Luke smiled and nodded to indicate that things were going well at his end. There was little more he could do.
Wait a second, Mara said. We seem to have a message coming through on a separate channel.
The picture fuzzed out and was replaced by one that was much crisper, one that caused Mara to smile broadly.
Ah, there you are, she said to the image of Leia. Finally paid your bills, did you?
Jason leaned forward over Mara's shoulder.
Mom!
Luke's sister smiled with relief at the sight of her son.
Hello, Jason.
Jason frowned.
Since when did the Falcon get outfitted with a holographic array?
Since never,
came the reply from his father, leaning in past Leia.
We're on the Solonia at the moment. How are things going there?
They're okay now, Jason said, but with communications down, I was starting to get worried.
Yeah, Han said. Sorry about that. The Vong have been keeping us busy.
They took out the communications relay bases at Gennaris and Esfandia, Leia explained. We've just gotten Esfandia up and running again, but Fan Gantry, the engineer here, is still trying to repair the damage. It'll be a while yet before communications are back to optimal.
Why would the relay bases be targeted?
Mara asked.
It's not as if they're major communications nodes in our war effort.
I think the Yuuzhan Vong are trying to come between us and the unknown regions, Leia said. Maybe to keep us and the Chiss from joining against them.
That might be part of it, Luke said.
Jason,
Han said. His crooked smile couldn't hide a parent's joy at seeing his son alive and well.
How about you, kid? You've been keeping your uncle and aunt on their toes?
Always.
Luke felt Jason's hand squeeze his shoulder.
How's Jaina?
She got a bit of a bump on her head, but apart from that, she's fine.
And Jag?
Busy overseeing our new allies, Leia said.
You should see these guys,
Han put in.
No two ships are the same. There's no central command.
Han shook his head disbelievingly.
It's crazy.
Who are you talking about?
Mara asked, frowning. The Rin, Leia said. Then with a brief shake of her head, she added, It's a long story, but they're friends, and they made a difference when it counted. We're glad to have them aboard.
What about Danny?
Han asked.
How's she doing?
She'll be okay, Jason said. Everyone's fine. We all love it here. It's going to be hard to leave.
Where's here exactly?
Zonama Seacoat,
Jason said, beaming widely.
You found it?
Leia looked aggrieved that it wasn't the first thing she'd been told.
Why didn't you say so before, Mara?
I thought I'd let Luke have the honor.
Mara smiled up at Luke, and a surge of excitement ran through him at the implication of this, something that up until now he hadn't had a chance to fully appreciate. He nodded, smiling.
We really did find it, against the odds. Is it everything you hoped it would be, Jason?
Han asked.
It's beautiful, Dad, and more powerful than we dared imagine. It's...
Jason hesitated, trying to find the right words. Luke could understand his nephew's difficulty with this. How did you put into words all that the living world represented, or the impact of standing on its soil embraced by its life force?
It's wonderful, Jason said finally.
But is it coming back with you? Leia asked, with an expression that suggested she was afraid of the answer.
It'll be ready to leave in about a week, Luke said. I figured we might as well stay until then to work out a few of its mysteries.
Congratulations to all of you, Leia said. That's the best news I've heard for months. The image flickered, then strengthened.
Sorry about that, Leia said. We're still fine-tuning here. We might have to cut this short so they can recalibrate the antennas.
Sad though he was to bring the communication to an end, Luke felt profoundly reassured on one level. His family and home were safe. Leia would have mentioned if there was anything wrong with Ben, or if the mall was under threat. When the antennas were fixed properly, he would patch through to his son's safe refuge and do his best to catch up. And when the war was over, he promised himself he would make up for the time he'd lost with his son. He knew what it was like to grow up without his father. He didn't want Ben to go through the same thing. "What about Tahiri?" Jason asked, a note of seriousness dampening his otherwise buoyant tone. "How is she?" Han and Leia exchanged a glance. "That's a little hard to explain to," Leia said.
"She's changed," Han said.
"For the better?" Jason asked grimly. Leia nodded.
"She's still finding out who she is, but I'm sure she'll get there."
"What name did she choose?" Luke asked.
"She still calls herself Tahiri, but..."
Leia stopped suddenly, her eyes narrowing as she studied her brother.
"Don't tell me you knew what was going to happen to her."
"I suspected," Luke said. "I thought she just needed time to work things out, and the opportunity to prove herself."
"Well, she's certainly done that," Leia said. Relief washed through him at the news.
"Then all's well that ends well, I guess."
"Seems so," Han said.
"We're heading back to Mon Cal now to refit and check in with our esteemed leader. He might have new orders for us."
"And the Rin have to be integrated into the intelligence network," Leia said. "I don't know how our usual spies are going to react to working with the likes of our new friends, but I'm sure we can bring them around."
"Travel safely," Luke said, "and we'll see you at Mon Cal within the next couple of weeks."
Leia nodded. "May the Force be with you, Luke." The hologram flickered and died entirely.
"And you, sister,"
he mumbled to where Leia's image had been a moment earlier. He sat silent for a long while, holding Mara's hand and thinking about his family, scattered in so many directions across the galaxy. One day, hopefully, he'd see them reunited in peaceful times, if everything went well with Zonama Seacoat.
"One step at a time,"
Mara said, as though reading his mind. Perhaps she was, he thought. Sometimes it seemed to him that his wife's green eyes could see right into his soul.
"The journey is changing us, Mara," he said. "We're not the same people we were when we set out."
"But that's life, my love," she said. "Without change, then we may as well be dead."
Luke smiled, feeling himself filled with the warmth of her affection. There were so many things he wanted to experience in the future, and all of them were with her. All they had to do was fix the problem of the Yuuzhan Vong, and everything else, he was sure, would fall into place.
"Jason, would you..."
Luke turned to ask his nephew to make sure Seacoat and Jabitha weren't growing restless outside the ship, but Jason was already gone.
"Do you think we embarrass him?"
Luke said.
"Maybe," she said, "or maybe he's just jealous of what we have together."
Luke was silent for a moment.
"Somehow, I don't think so."
Danny was talking to the young Ferroan girl Tesha under the eaves of a looming Boros. The afternoon sun made the air heavy with heat, but in the shade it was almost cool. There was a pregnancy to the undergrowth, as though it might part at any moment to reveal some strange new form of life. Jason paused to lean on a root elbowing out of the ground nearby and listened in.
"And then," the Ferroan child was saying, "I want to see where Anakin came from and Obi-Wan."
"You mean Coruscant?" Danny asked, glancing at Jason and offering a fleeting smile before returning her attention to the girl.
"Yes," Tesha said. "It must be the most amazing place."
"It was," Danny said. "I don't know what it looks like now."
"We'll go there," Tesha said. "We'll go there and get rid of the far outsiders and rebuild the world of cities." "I hope you're right, Tesha."
Danny smoothed a stray lock of golden hair from the girl's forehead.
"I really hope you are."
The girl smiled up at her new friend, and together they discussed where they'd visit first, when Coruscant was safe again.
"Is this the planet speaking?"
Jason wondered as he listened.
"Or a girl brought up on stories of far-off places she never dreamed she would see?"
Whatever the source of the urge, Jason wondered where he would go if Zonama Seacoat helped the Galactic Alliance return peace to the galaxy. There was no easy answer. His memories of Coruscant were a mess of good and bad, spanning his entire life. Part of him was tempted to encourage the tearing down of the city planet from Skyhook to deepest basement, so that something new could be built in its place. But who would decide what should take its place? Who deserved that responsibility? Jason was distracted by a low chuckle coming from the undergrowth. He looked up to see the image of Verger standing near him, her feathery fringe dancing in a virtual breeze.
Things come and go, Jason Solo, Seacoat said. We both know that.
Are you reading my mind?
He asked. Perhaps you still wonder sometimes why I woke you first when you arrived here. This and many other things you will understand in time.
He stared at his hands for a moment. I wish you wouldn't appear to me in that form. I find it disconcerting. Like this, then?
Asked the child, who would one day become Darth Vader. He met the disturbingly blue stare of his grandfather as directly as he could.
Why do you have to take on any form? Why can't you just be who you are?
Because you couldn't begin to comprehend who I am, Seacoat said, returning to the image of Verger. There are limits to your understanding, just as there are limits to mine. Mine, however, are an order of magnitude removed from yours. Take no offense, Jason Solo, but my talking to you now is like you talking to a dust mite that crawled across your skin. Do you believe that such a mite could understand you if you were to speak to it normally? Do you think you would even hear a reply if you listened with your normal ears?
Seacoat shook Verger's head in answer to its own question.
Of course not. In order to communicate between such diverse scales of existence, one or both sides must change. For the moment, I am prepared to make that change.
Only for the moment? Jason repeated.
We'll see what the future holds.
Seacoat's expression was concerned, not threatening, yet Jason felt distinctly unsettled by the conversation. What were they getting themselves into? They were bargaining with a creature literally beyond their comprehension. Who knew what its motives or goals were, or whether it had some hidden agenda?
Do you know what it is I crave?
Said the living planet through the image of Verger. Jason shrugged.
Peace, knowledge, a clear conscience?
All those things are required for a good life, and all of them have a price.
That's what you want, then, to pay the price and earn a good life?
Seacoat smiled with Verger's face.
I think that's what we all want, Jason Solo.
With those few words, Seacoat slowly melted away, and Jason was left alone to ponder them. Tahiri was in one of the Salonia's empty holds, exercising. She wasn't hiding as such, but was definitely trying to keep out of the way. It gave her an excuse to work on her technique. Since merging the two halves of herself, she'd been struggling to assimilate more than just ways of thought, speech, and being. The old Tahiri and Rena had fought in very different ways, and she needed to refine the technique so she could more effectively incorporate both the next time she had to go into combat. As she sparred with shadows, tossing her lightsaber from hand to hand, and kicking powerfully, leaping gracefully, striking the air with unerring accuracy, her mind kept a ceaseless running commentary.
Jedi Force Leap, Asthkor, Throat Hold, Sand People High Kick, Quad Double Punch.
Why'd you let him go?
The voice came from behind her and echoed through the hold. Tahiri didn't break her rhythm even for a moment. She'd known he was coming 20 seconds before he appeared in the entrance. She performed one last fluid leap and landed firmly on both feet, her body now fully facing Han Solo. Tahiri extinguished her lightsaber, returning the pommel to her belt. She walked casually toward Han.
Let who go?
She asked, even though she knew who he was referring to.
Droma.
Han's voice was thick with frustration.
I was getting worried because I hadn't heard from him since we docked, so I started asking around. Captain Maine told me that a Rin ship called Fortune Seeker docked briefly with the Salonia not long ago, and now Jag informs me that Twin Suns escorted that ship to its hyperspace jump point. He didn't know whether or not Droma was on board, of course, but I'm guessing that you do, seeing as you were the one who requested the escort for the ship in the first place. So I'll ask you again, why did you let him go?
Tahiri offered a slight shrug.
Because he asked me to.
Han took two steps into the room. His expression was clouded. Hurt, too, although he would never admit to that. He would claim that he was angry at having been deceived. But really, there had been no deception. He just hadn't been told.
Why you? Han asked. Why wouldn't he talk to me?
That was the core of it, she knew. He was transparent to her. She could see through his reserve with the cold clarity of an alien warrior and read his innermost thoughts with the sensitivity of a Jedi. She felt for him, in her own way.
Because he knew you would ask questions, she said. You're too much a part of the system he is trying to work around. There can be only so much overlap before the members of the Rin Network lose the thing that makes them special, and become like you, blind in subtle ways, vulnerable when you can't afford to be. For now, you and he must stand apart, until the day that peace comes. Han shook his head.
Droma wasn't a part of that network. They turned him down.
She smiled at his naivete. Do you remember Onodax?
Onodax?
What's that got to— Droma gave me a message to give to you, she cut in smoothly. He said to tell you that he hopes your timing's better next time, and that he still doesn't want your money.
Timing? Money? Confusion quickly became realization. The creep who interrogated me at that bar? That was Droma?
She didn't take any pleasure in the way Han had been fooled. He encouraged the riot on Onodax to cover your getaway, and his too. He'd been running the Rin network through that operation, the bar, for 6 months. That was about 3 months longer than he would have liked, he said, but it was necessary to take that much time to make sure everything was running properly. Once he was sure it was, he could move on. When you're the head of such a secretive organization, he said, you don't want to sit still too long. Their strength lies in their—
Wait a minute,
Han said, shaking his head in bewilderment.
The head of the organization? Droma? The Rin?
Makes sense if you think about it. Your involvement with him gave him a very high standing with all the Rin. His species has been leaderless for a very long time. Not that they want what we would traditionally regard as a leader. They're nomads, born to be wanderers and therefore endlessly exploited. They're expected to wander all over the galaxy, so few security people will stop them, beyond the usual harassment. And if someone sees Rin working, they'll usually leave them alone. The Rin go everywhere, see everything, and talk endlessly to each other by notes, songs, and rumors carried by trading ships. They're frequent stowaways, so few people would become suspicious at finding Rin where they weren't meant to be. She shrugged. What he's done is take what most people regard as being the Rin's weaknesses and turn them into strengths.
Who'd have thought? Han mused with a smile curling one corner of his mouth.
She nodded.
Han shook his head, losing the smile. I still don't understand why he had to leave so soon, or why he couldn't tell me all this himself.
She faced his incomprehension squarely. The more people who know about him and his Rin network, the greater the risk he runs. The less evidence exists that he runs the whole thing, the safer he becomes. His family won't betray him, and neither will you. But there are people farther removed he can't necessarily trust. The Rin have learned the hard way not to place their faith in strangers.
And what about you? Han said. I'd have thought you were more of a stranger to him than me.
Given the reports he'd received from Gower on Bakura, as well as the Rin on Galantos, Droma offered to adopt me into the movement.
The fact that you're telling me this now suggests you didn't accept his offer.
She shook her head. I was tempted briefly, but I decided against it. For the moment, anyway.
The truth was, it was too early to decide what she was going to do with herself. She was no longer trying to walk two divergent paths simultaneously, tearing herself apart in the process. She was finally walking the one path, and she enjoyed the idea of continuing down that path until she figured out just what she wanted to do, no matter how long that took. With a sigh, Han's hurt softened and became disappointment.
I would have liked the chance to tell him how good it was to see him again, you know?
I do know, she said. And so did he.
I don't like the idea of not saying goodbye to my friends. These days you can't be sure that you're ever going to see them again.
I don't think you have to worry about that, she said. You'll see Droma again, maybe sooner than you think.
Han's smile returned then. He didn't look convinced by Tahiri's words of comfort, but he clearly appreciated them.
Thanks, Tahiri, he said.
All wounds heal with time, she said.
The words rang with a truth that made her shiver. After so long, she could finally say them with absolute conviction.
All guilt fades, and opposites become one.
Is that so?
He said with a perceptive look. Perhaps you should try telling that to the people who made you like this. She thought about this as she watched Han walk out of the room and return to his ship. Yun Yamka, the Slayer, hung around her neck in the form of the small silver pendant that she had found on Galantos. It held no significance for her now at all, except as a symbol. It served as a reminder, sometimes grim, more often triumphant, of everything she had endured while finding her new self.
Maybe I will tell them, she thought when Han had gone. Maybe I will.